Hi, in this episode, we are discussing the book Future Food: How Modern Science is Transforming the Way We Eat, published in 2019 and written by David Julian McClemens. He is a British food scientist and distinguished professor at the University of Massachusetts. Nanotech is the science of dealing with materials at the size and the range of nanometers. It's about 1,000 times smaller than human hair. And with that size come also very special benefits, but also drawbacks. You can have the same material either in its standard form or broken down into nanoparticles, sometimes even through very non-fancy processes like grinding and cooking food. You find nanoparticles naturally in the oil bodies in nuts, seeds, and beans, and lipoproteins in eggs. So the large surface area of nanoparticles is what makes them oftentimes more interesting. They have different optical, electromagnetic, physical, or chemical properties that are used already for pesticides, fertilizers, and sometimes also directly in food products. One example is copper hydroxide. These nanoparticles are used as pesticides to treat crops. Silver nanoparticles may be embedded in packaging materials and sprayed on crops to kill microbes that cause food spoilage or illness. In this case, it's all about the antimicrobial properties. Titanium dioxide is used to increase the whiteness and brightness of foods. And actually, the author McClemens mentions in his book that there's a study by Professor Paul Westerhoff and his colleagues at Arizona State University that showed that there are high levels of titanium dioxide in a range of commercially available products, including candies, chewing gums, powdered donuts, yogurts, dressings, and milk powders. So in this episode, we do dive into some topics discussed in the book, but we also talk about regulation again, because this seems to be a real theme in this season. This season is brought to you by the Adalbert Raps Foundation, supporting applied food science research for sustainability. My amazing co-host is Frank Kühne, who is Foundation Executive Board Member at this foundation. And he's also the Chief of Advisory Board of the ingredients producer Raps, focused on spices and herbs. Oh, and an important side note, my microphone malfunctioned during this episode, so I'm sorry for that, and I hope you will get some extra value from the voiceovers. Let's jump right in.
Red to Green is the most in-depth podcast on food sustainability. And in this season 7, we discuss key takeaways from books on the food system. I'm your host, Marina Schmidt, and I'm joined by my co-host, Frank Kühne.
When I started reading the book, I felt like that's so 20s, like so last century discussion. Mm-hmm. Nanotechnology, like, kind of was, when I was a student, something people would talk about, and I was completely surprised. And I've been for the last 20 years in the food industry. Nanotechnology, actually, the first time I've heard about it again is this last week. And I'm in science too, so I don't have any food scientists around me talking about nanotechnology. I was very much surprised about that.
Yeah.
Quite sure how you felt about that.
Yeah, well, he does describe a lot of potential application points for nanotechnology. And it all comes down to how much you trust regulation and how much one trusts safety measurements. And actually, it's interesting, if you look into toxicology, there used to be a time where there was a debate, okay, what is toxic and what is not toxic? And when the measurements and the ways of measuring toxicity became really accurate, at some point, it became the question, how toxic is it? And is it okay given the benefits? Interestingly, I had a podcast episode with the founder of Archeon, which is a gas fermentation startup. He mentioned that in France, titanium oxide was banned, this nanoparticle, because it was used, for example, in M&Ms to make the M more crisp and sharp, because the nanoparticles, they reflect the light in a way that is more bright.
Yeah.
And the French government said that's an unnecessary, unessential benefit for something that is potentially harmful, and they banned it. And now M&M found a more natural solution, which also looks not as crisp, but seriously, like, who cares? I think it's really important to look at for what is it used. I find it interesting that the main thing why it's so contested is also its main benefit, because they're so small that they can penetrate the pores of plants. They can make vitamins more available because it goes through our gut wall potentially and into the body, which can be good if the nanoparticles help you absorb certain micronutrients or vitamins. It can be super bad if this is a nanoparticle which helps your body absorb more pesticides.
Because we don't take them in our body, like they come out at the other end and then pollute. Sorry, I'm not quite sure how to say that properly in English, but like it's coming out and it's polluting our environment and we don't know what's happening to those kinds of articles.
Actually, I would rather say the issue is that they do not come out.
Okay.
Yeah, because and they may be absorbed, because they may
accumulated in our body. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And you don't know what's happening then there. Okay, where do they accumulate and what impact do they have?
As with so many things in the food system and in life, just because it's a certain technology doesn't mean it's inherently bad. You can actually cluster nanoparticles on a diagram in two dimensions. So imagine from left to right, you would distinguish between their composition. So whether they are organic or inorganic, made synthetically. And on the y-axis from top to the bottom, you could distinguish them by being digestible or indigestible. Typically, indigestible and inorganic nanoparticles, like for example nanosilver, are more problematic than organic ones. Titanium dioxide is another example. And fun fact, even though it was considered safe while the author wrote the book, now it's not considered safe in the EU anymore. One of the main issues with nanoparticles is that they can permeate the gut wall, so they can pass through the gut wall into the rest of the body. But as said, you wouldn't worry about that with certain nuts or milk. In certain cases, it's more worrisome than in others.
So you can find it on vegetables or fruits if it's a pesticide. Then you can find it also in processed foods as an additive, just for making it wider or changing the functionality. So for you, like, you have a spice company. Have you ever encountered
nanotechnology? No.
Yeah.
Now, I found it very interesting then, but he said he's doing research on spices, creating nanoparticles that prolong the shelf life of food. I think that cloves and cinnamon,
thyme,
and he's using some of the oils to put them in nanoparticles and using that to fight against microorganisms in food, so prolonging the shelf life. That was something that caught my attention, but I never have actually heard about that. While reading the book, we have been using, but I'm not sure if it's nanotechnology, we have been using a certain technology to grind, what is it called again? Something like a wheat. We grind something like a wheat and really, really fine particles. And what we realized is we were grinding them and there were these little tubes we could produce out of these fine powder, or with that, like the fine powder was the little tubes. And we blended them into meat products and they had this kind of effect. They were binding water in meat products, or in food products in general. So that was quite exciting because you could, I'm quite sure not people won't like that, but you could add value for a product suddenly because you could bind in more water into it and it didn't get watery. And we were starting to produce the product and suddenly we had allergic reactions at some of our employees who were working with the product. And we realized because of the powder being so fine, even if they were wearing some kind of protection, little particles ended up in their nose and in their respiratory system, and they had an allergic shock And we actually had to stop after only a week or so the whole production of the product, and which shows kind of the risk when you're working with these kind of nanotechnologies. Now, I have to admit, I wouldn't call them nanotechnologies, but they were so small and so fine that they were actually penetrating the protective gear.
So just to clarify, so you were grinding wheat?
Yeah, some kind of wheat. Yeah,
Kind of specific wheat, and it was broken down into cubes?
In little pipes, in nanopipes. And if you use a nanopipe, you have this kind of sucking effect of water into it, like in a straw. And that is then keeping the water in the product or in the powder, and that is then being put into a meat product. And then by that, you have a higher yield with the meat product.
That makes sense, because the author, Mike Clemens, also notes that quite often nanoparticles are created through the processing itself. So through homogenization, grinding, and cooking. So yeah, your process created nanoparticles, and it created also some unintended side effects.
In his book, he mentioned at one point that the users of nanotechnology don't like to use the term because the consumer is not very keen in eating a product that contains nanotechnology, which again shows there's this consumer idea of nanotechnology and there's a food science idea in the background where a risk assessment is happening and people are actually looking at the product and asking, is the benefit bigger than the damage it might cause?
And here, just a quick shout out to the Adalbert Raps Foundation. And that's also a great opportunity for startups and for researchers, for people who are working on their master thesis or their PhD thesis, or the next big idea that can turn the food system upside down in the positive sense. The Adalbert Raps Foundation is offering grants to scientific institutions, sometimes also working with startups. I've asked Frank what kind of topics they're actually offering grants for.
I think you can rule out anything which is nutrition. So any kind of consumer studies. We don't go out and because we don't believe that we have the knowledge to tell you what an entrepreneur or scientist should do. It should be the other way around. He should come to us because of his idea or her idea, his knowledge, and then basically say, look, that's something I want to achieve. So biggest headline is impact for us and not this or that topic we want to address. Changing the food system to a better food system.
Check out the Adalbert Raps Foundation by typing it into Google or by following the links in the show notes. You can also connect with Frank Alexander Kühne on LinkedIn and just ping him directly.
I had two cases where food safety and health protection was crucial, like where I was put on the spot to make decision about things the law forced me and the watching organization in the background, like the Consumer Protection and the Food Regulatory, Food Safety Institution of the German government, basically. Mm-hmm. And at the one point, we weren't directly impacted, but kind of had the whole industry, an impact on the industry. And it was about this famous company, Fuchs, which is it's a huge spice producer, seasoning producer in Europe. And they were producing for quite a lot of crisps or chips, as the British, I think, say. They were producing a paprika seasoning for that. And the paprika seasoning was contaminated with salmonella. And they had a huge callback and had to destroy the products which already were being produced in the shelves of the supermarket and so on. And us being as competition, being involved in the same market, we had to assess certain products in the same way. Now, the craziest thing is if you do the math in the background, the amount a consumer had to consume on a daily basis to be in the risk of being contaminated with salmonella would have been 15 kilograms of chips per day.
Great. Well, and then they would suffer from other things than salmonella.
Yeah, exactly. So, which was bizarre, but that's the way the system works. And you were talking about this kind of toxicology and that there are different levels and grades now, and the sensors and the mechanics in the background are so fine and well tuned. And there's another one which was bizarre. We had a huge issue a couple of years ago with nutmegs from Indonesia, which were contaminated with a toxic mycelium, like a mushroom, basically. And you, for a year, you couldn't buy any nutmegs worldwide, at least as a European. The level were defined in a way that none of the nutmegs, freshly harvested or processed or in our warehouse, were allowed to be sold. We had to destroy them. And now you have to understand that a nutmeg is the inner core of a fruit. So the problem for nutmeg was it was being put on the same level as other oily seeds, like sunflower seeds. But the amount of nutmegs you're consuming is, you know, like everybody has perhaps a nutmeg in his spice shelf, which is 15 years old or older, because you use only a tiny little bit of it, like in micrograms, you're using it. It's so intense. It's actually a very strong drug. Mm-hmm. But it was compared to a normal oil seed consumption. And again, you had the same problem that the amount of nutmegs you would have to consume is, you would die before that, and not because of the toxic mycelium you could find traces of.
You would be too high to keep eating nutmegs at some point.
Yeah, exactly. No, yeah, you actually die because of the amount. It's like eating three or four nutmegs, like chewing them.
They're that bad?
You can't eat a whole nutmeg. No.
I would try it. Maybe that's the next cinnamon challenge, you know?
That could be a TikTok challenge, yeah. Who's brave enough to eat a nutmeg? No, what you do is, I think they do smoke it. Like you grind it down and you can smoke it. But I don't want to get any stupid ideas into your podcast here. But what I wanted to show you is, I agree with you, the European system seems to be pretty good. And it still sometimes misses the mark. Yeah. And I've been talking about risk and opportunities. And at that point, I think a more reasonable approach would have been good for the industry and the consumer.
Yeah. And that also highlights the connection between food waste and safety.
Yeah.
And packaging also comes in there, right? Here you don't want plastic packaging, but that may lead to contamination of the food. That may lead to actual increase in food waste. So we always have these competing interests.
Yeah.
So one of the questions he asks is to clarify whether one thinks this is a good idea is, would you feed this to your daughter? I mean, not spoonfuls, but would you let your children eat foods which have nanoparticles, and under what conditions?
Speaking as a consumer, no. I'd rather stay away from that. No, that's bizarre. Yeah, that's like my primal brain tells me don't do that. Yeah, my rational brain says, well, if it's food approved in Europe, so there's been a verification that it's been usable.
But I find this so interesting because look how skeptical we are, and it makes me understand people who are skeptical about cellular agriculture, because in the end, the arguments are all the same. Right? It's always this, maybe. Yeah, it's not natural. It seems a bit risky. We don't know. Like, we understand too little about how things actually work. And the main difference for me is that cultured meat, like, you would be able to decide, okay, I, for myself, decide I'm going to eat cultured meat. And I am the one taking that risk and potential benefit.
So to clarify this part, what I meant to say is that it makes a difference whether it is clearly communicated or not. And if this is just part of the chewing gum, I mean, of course, actually, if you eat chewing gum, can you really expect that this is like super good stuff in there? No, probably not. But I mean, if you eat sugar powder donuts, and there's just very little transparency of what is in the food, it just makes it a bit more uncomfortable, because there's actually no way to find out whether this has nanoparticles in it, except just defaulting to low processed foods. That's, I guess we are coming over and over back to that point. A really interesting side note, Mac Clemens, the author of the book, actually answered this question himself. And he also said that he wouldn't feel comfortable with his daughter eating nanoparticles in general as so often, but it really depends on, is this organic, inorganic? Are these digestible? Are they indigestible? And of course, what is the use case for that? Would the alternative, would a different kind of pesticide or fertilizer be worse than the nano version of it or not?
So I think in certain cases, I find it super interesting. For example, his all-natural antimicrobial solution, right? So he said, We are developing all-natural edible antimicrobial nanoparticles. They're packed full of essential oils extracted from edible plants such as thyme, garlic, cloves, peppermint, lemon, or cinnamon. And that makes so much sense, like the way that he describes the rationale for it. These essential oils are secreted by plants as a natural defense mechanism against pests. Mm-hmm. Evolutionary pressures have designed them to be highly effective against a broad spectrum of pests. We have shown that our antimicrobial nanoparticles can penetrate microbes and kill them by causing their outer coatings to be disrupted and their internal biochemical machinery to malfunction. Wow, that sounds violent, but okay.
There's a war going on that level, clearly, every day, every minute. Yeah. But yeah, okay.
Yeah, but that's good. That's fine. If it's that to me seems sensible.
Yeah.
But did he answer the question himself, if he would feed his daughter? I can't remember. I think so, right?
Yes, he did. Here, I would have to answer it depends on the nanoparticles. I already feed my daughter nanoparticles when I give her milk or yogurt for her breakfast. Yeah, wow, those are natural nanoparticles.
Exactly. And to make it clear, he's not using a natural particle of essential oils. He's using a nanoparticle to transport essential oils to the microorganism. I think that, so there's an artificial part in it. Yeah. Is that the limitation? Is that the line we draw? If something is existing in nature, it's good. And if it's not existing in nature, it's bad. I don't think that can't be the answer. And then even if you're consuming too much thyme, essential oil, it might harm you, yeah?
Yeah, the tricky thing is to distinguish between long and short-term toxicity. So to quote, to date, there's little evidence that those nanoparticles currently found in foods cause acute toxic effects, which is probably because they are present at relatively low levels. It is possible, however, that certain kinds of nanoparticles could lead to chronic toxicity if consumed at low levels over a long period. And there's no sufficient evidence because it's so hard carry out long-term studies on humans. Yeah.
Do you know my father died due to Parkinson? And out of that, our foundation did finance for quite a long time research on the reason for Parkinson. Like, why does Parkinson exist, a disease or illness in our society? And a professor we funded from the Erlangen University in Germany published a paper, it's already 4 or 5 years old, about the impact of nutrition on our microbiome and the inability of our body to transport these kind of, that he called it, waste protein out of our body. They were accumulating in our body, and that is ending up in the brain and causing a dysfunction in the brain, which is then causing Parkinson as a disease. So I'm telling that because you can see how nutrition might have an impact on a long-term level, causing diseases, which takes decades to really understand that is coming somewhere else. It's one, now I have to say, it's one theory. Yeah. So I'm pretty sure after the last 4 years, there have been other theories on what is causing Parkinson.
Yeah. Which also makes it so much harder to evaluate what food is good or bad.
Absolutely.
Like in our first season on cellular agriculture, I talked to Blonalo. They're making cell-based fish. And in the introduction, I researched a bit on heavy metal contamination of fish. You would be surprised, like any kind of fish one can eat is usually heavily contaminated with PCBs, with fire retardants, with mercury, and wild fish is, of course, getting increasingly contaminated. And the shocking thing is that it gets passed on, right? Like a mother who has eaten a lot of heavy metal fish throughout her life passes on remnants of mercury PCBs to the child. So the child can be born and has a lot of these already in the system, which influence the child much more because any kind of low-level concentration is super impactful for our little baby. So I talked to a friend of mine who's working with a lot of women on fertility issues, and she said more and more women have issues conceiving, like on both sides, so the fertility rates are decreasing because anything, our entire environment is having its effect.
Hey, if you're enjoying this episode or this season, it would be amazing if you can share it in any WhatsApp, Slack, or Discord group of your choice. Red to Green has been in the top 5% most followed and shared podcasts of Spotify. It takes a minute and it really helps us keep doing this. So it's super appreciated. Back to the episode.
I visit exhibitions. I talk to ingredient suppliers. I talk to ingredient designers. Nanotechnology wasn't a term being used over the last two decades in the industry in any discussion. And he says it's economically, in most cases, not viable because it's far too expensive to use them. So what I wanted to point out is I think he's talking about the potential of that technology. It's not a technology being used widely in the industry. That is at least my experience, one perspective evaluation of the whole thing.
So let's say the opportunities for application, right? So nanofertilizers, we talked about that. It's so useful because it can pass through pores and it increases stickiness. And here I find interesting that he describes because the fertilizers would stick more on the plants, less would run off into the environment and less would pollute the surroundings. But again, there's the trade-off between what is better for the environment and then personal human health, because that also means that you cannot wash them off that easily.
Yeah.
Apparently, in a study, they showed that an additional $26 per acre spent on nanofertilizers increased the yield of watermelons by around $4,600 per acre. And then he says, many of the nanofertilizers developed in academic laboratories are unsuitable for use in real life situations because they are not economically viable. That sounds very economically viable to me.
I thought, yeah, I was surprised about that as well. Yeah. I would spend $26 if I'm going to get $4,600 out of that.
Yeah. That sounds like the next kind of investment scam.
Yeah.
How to make money quickly.
Use nano-fertilizer. Yeah. I actually, when I read that, I actually thought I should buy that nano-fertilizer for my garden.
Absolutely. Yeah. But also, yeah, the second application area that I wrote down was water filtering and desalination.
We have been funding research at the University of Basel on a slightly different topic, but they were using nanomembranes to more evenly distribute CO2 in the pipes to grow microalgae.
Okay, so you would try to grow microalgae and to distribute CO2 better in the water because the algae feed on CO2.
Yeah.
You would use nanomembranes
where you push the CO2 into the water to evenly and finally distribute the CO2. Produces less foam and less issue in the production of microalgae.
Actually, the use case for desalination is super relevant because, of course, we are depleting freshwater resources and typical methods of desalination like reverse osmosis are effective but super energy intensive. So a nanomembrane could be a low-energy alternative. However, the author of Future Foods argues that this is very promising, yet it needs a lot more research to become economically viable.
And I guess, that, again, the same thing, of course, that they are not made of steel. So some of these nanoparticles would also end up in the water afterwards, I would argue. So we did talk about pesticides. It's interesting that he mentions that nanoparticles can be used by putting pesticides inside of them. So the nanoparticles whose size, shape, and charge are tailored to enhance their effectiveness would have a pesticide inside them.
It's like the solution with essential oils and the spices. Like they, you remember I said components, ingredients, and delivery systems. So one topic the food industry or food science is addressing are delivery system, like how to deliver under certain circumstances a certain ingredient in a food product or in that case, the agriculture system. So by that, reducing the amount of pesticides you need or the amount of flavor you would need. That's something we do. And I think he names that in his book too, as a delivery system.
If you don't remember Frank mentioning the system, that's very normal because we haven't included it in this episode. But here I'll quickly summarize it. It means that the food industry is producing components, ingredients, and delivery systems. Components, let's say, being whole cuts of beef or the actual crops, ingredients more broken down like precision fermentation, casein, etc., or certain flavorings and the delivery systems, as Frank describes now, is how can you actually, for example, encapsulate certain vitamins to make them more bioavailable.
So we really understand nanotechnology because of its ability, because of its size, you know, the physics work differently, and they need to link to a pore or link to a microorganism. Because of that, they're going to release their pesticides, for example. So it's they don't need...
Yeah, they can penetrate into the plant.
Yeah, yeah.
And he does say the nanoparticles may be trapped within capsules.
Oh, is it? Okay.
Yeah, it's in the devil is getting the details here, but still, like, the main part is that because it's a nanoparticle, it is able to get into the interior of the plant. It's not just outside. It's actually, like, in the roots, in the stems, in the leaves, and kills the pathogen, even if it's inside the plant already.
Mm. Yeah.
So that also makes it more effective. And at the same time, again, like, then you really cannot get the pesticides off. So maybe it's better because in the end, the amount of nanopesticides is so low, or because they can get through the gut lining, it's worse. It's hit or miss, like right now as we're going through this list. Like one of them I like, one of them I don't like, but the next one is sensible. It's for crop evaluation, and that would actually replace the process of using laboratories where farmers would need to send in some crops to a laboratory to find out what kind of pest there is on them. Instead, he talks about a lab on a chip approach. So actually, the nanoparticles would be used to detect the presence of pathogens on crops. Researchers have already shown that sensors made from carbon nanotubes can be absorbed by plants and send signals to a smartphone when a crop becomes contaminated with pesticides. How cool is that?
That is really sci-fi.
You just get a little alert from your nanoparticles. Notification.
So there were a couple more areas that the author actually mentions in the book, which because of limited time, we didn't get into, including various use cases and packaging for multi-layered materials, for antimicrobial properties, and to actually support bio-based packaging. Because bio-based packaging, as we've mentioned in our season 2 on plastic alternatives, still needs some help to get to the resilience and use cases of traditional plastic. Another interesting example of a nanostructured material is biochar. And we actually mentioned this in our previous episode on the carbon footprint of everything. But biochar is a substance that's created when you burn agricultural waste under a specific reduced oxygen level. And this is super nutrient dense and can increase crop yields, but it also prevents the carbon from being released into the environment. So it's a positive thing, but it's also super, super expensive. As a last interesting use case would actually be supply chain transparency. Apparently, you can use nanotechnology now to create miniature forensic devices capable of providing information about food properties cheaply and quickly. On our website, redtogreen.solutions, you will actually find a little cheat sheet that I made. So these are just my notes from the book, and I have categorized the different examples that McClemens mentions into bigger topics like antimicrobials or the use cases for desalination, etc. So if you want to read up on that, you can just go to redtogreen.solutions and you will find the video for this podcast episode and also my book notes.
Yeah. Are you going to recommend the book to somebody else?
I would recommend the book to people who have a focus on nutrition, who want to understand the technical parts of what makes things nutritious, and somebody who would like to dive more deeply into nanotechnology. And you, would you recommend it?
It's I think it's a very heavy book in regard of dense information and covering quite a lot of fields. You would need to have a bit of understanding to actually sort out everything he's explaining.
Yeah.
Definitely not a book where you said to your mom, that's a great book, have a read, get a bit of understanding about how our food system works. I think it's really, yeah, true, isn't it? It's not a hands-on book where you go into the supermarket, that, oh, nanotechnology, no. Ah, oh, another nanotechnology, yes, it's not. Yeah, so I think on the other side,
of course,
it might have been
because it's also super complex.
It's super complex, but yeah, that is true.
I definitely yawned a lot. I don't know whether it's because I was reading it always late in the evening. But it was definitely, it's also a good like thing to read before bed, maybe, sometimes.
Okay, David, if you're listening, we're sorry for that.
Like, it's because it's well-researched, I think.
Yeah.
So overall, yeah, if you're a food tech nerd, yep, something to read.
That's for sure. Yeah.
Thank you for listening to this episode. If you learned something, then make sure to subscribe to the podcast and to our videos. And check out the other episodes. A special thanks to the entire team of Red to Green, especially our audio editors Radhika Ramahantlan and Sales Gupta. Until next time, let's move the food industry from harmful to healthy, from polluting to sustainable, from red to green.